Welcome back to The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the story goes that author and journalist Robert Kersen was visiting the Museum of Science and Industry. After all, he had written a huge book about the U-boat submarine called Shadow Divers, one of the best. But while at the museum, his attention was diverted to an exhibit featuring the Apollo 8 spacecraft. Many know that the Apollo 8 was the first manned mission to the moon in 1968, but what about the details? The intimate details and the lead-up to the famed Apollo 8 mission is told in Kersen's new book, already a bestseller, called Rocket Men, The Daring Odyssey of Apollo 8 and the Astronauts Who Made Man's First Journey to the Moon. In it, Kersen talks with the famed astronauts and others surrounding the Apollo 8 mission that culminated in the journey to the moon, and in doing so wrote a tremendous story about ambition, danger, politics, and American spirit. Robert Kersen is an award-winning journalist who used to work at the Sun-Times, and he's in studio with me tonight at the big table. Mr. Kersen, thanks for being here.
Great to be with you, Justin. Thank you.
Was that an accurate portrayal of that story?
Totally perfect. I could not have done it better myself.
It's interesting because of all the space stories, you talk about the space race and all the things that have happened when it comes to our history with space, you said this is the story to tell.
This, in my mind, is the greatest story of space exploration ever. And I also think it's one of the great exploration stories in the history of mankind. It is, after all, the first time human beings ever left home and the first time we ever arrived at a new world and arrived at our most ancient companion, the moon, which has been calling to us since our evolution.
As someone who knows a lot about history, you've written a lot of great biographies and nonfiction in your life. How much did you know about this story before you embarked on the intimate details?
I knew almost nothing, and that's even after fancying myself a fan of space exploration and the Apollo program. Like so many people, I was much more familiar with Apollo 11, which is the first moon landing, and Apollo 13, in which the crew almost doesn't make it back after explosion near the moon. So I thought I knew a lot, but as I get older, I realize how much depends on luck and right turns instead of left turns in life. And I took a right turn instead of a left turn in the Museum of Science and Industry and came across this beautiful space capsule that looked, you know, at once to have come from the past and the future. And I knew almost nothing about it. It said Apollo 8, and it said man's first journey to the moon. But beyond that, I knew nothing. I went home, I opened the books and started to read. And within 15 minutes, I knew that I had come across probably the greatest space story of all time.
You're absolutely right in the sense that the Apollo missions, the big ones that everybody is going to gravitate to, Apollo 11, which was the Neil Armstrong on the moon, the Apollo 13, of course, made famous by the movie with Tom Hanks. But you're absolutely right. This predates that. And there wouldn't be those missions without the Apollo 8.
There really wouldn't. And one of the first things that suggested to me that I was dealing with such an incredible story was the way other astronauts, including and especially Neil Armstrong, talked about Apollo 8. Neil Armstrong was on the backup crew for Apollo 8. And when he spoke about it, his voice was reverential. He spoke about Apollo 8 almost as if he considered it to be an even greater leap for mankind than Apollo 11. I had to understand why, and that was really the start of this whole thing.
Well, we'll talk about the story coming up here. For you to write this book, what goes into it? Obviously, there's a lot of history and there's a lot of documented footage and accounts that have been done, but you went and talked to the astronauts. Talk about your process of being able to get their story, a story that has been told, into this book.
Yes. The first thing I did was to check if the crew was still living and where they were. And in fact, they were all living, all three of them. And one of them, Jim Lovell, lived not 15 minutes from me.
He's the famous one that for Illinois.
He was the commander on Apollo 13 from the movie you mentioned with Tom Hanks. So I thought my first job is to get a hold of Jim Lovell if possible. And it turned out that he had been a big fan of my first book, Shadow Divers, the one about the U-boat. And so I had kind of an inside track with him and was able to meet with him. He's one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet in the world. You always hear that about him, but in person, it's even more true somehow. And once I began talking to him, he called the other two crew members, Frank Borman, who was the commander of Apollo 8, and Bill Anders, who was the youngest member of the team on Apollo 8. And we were off to the races from there.
Jim Lovell, of course, you see his name in everything from the museums, of course, all the different museums, and he comes on media, and he's on WGN radio at different times. But a lot of times, you're right, everyone talks about Apollo 13. There doesn't seem to be much put on Apollo 8, but you know he had a huge role in what happened with this mission, the one that really was the reason the others happened.
He really did, and even before Apollo 8, he was on two Gemini space flights, including Gemini 7, where he flew with Frank Borman for 14 days in a capsule no bigger than the front half of a Volkswagen Beetle. For 14 days, if you can imagine that. When they came back and stepped on the recovery ship, Lovell said, "I'd like to announce our engagement." So he was always funny, even just back from outer space.
Those guys are really good at quotes at the right time. That's what I picked up from your book, is that, you know, you get this opportunity to speak, whether you're in space in the orbit of the moon or you're about to land or like you just said, coming out of a little cockpit, and they all have the right things to say at the right time.
They really did. They're such intelligent, bright guys. And one of the miracles about the whole NASA era then is that NASA left the speaking to the astronauts. They didn't tell them what to say, didn't screen it. And that part of that would be a huge factor on Apollo 8.
It's amazing. Robert Kersen is in studio tonight. He is the author of Rocket Men, The Daring Odyssey of Apollo 8 and the Astronauts Who Made Man's First Journey to the Moon. All right, we'll do this. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll start this story. This story is tremendous, and it's not just about, it's awesome, the details of the actual launch and mission, but the lead up to that, everything that goes into what we know to be the space race, is fascinating. Robert Kersen in studio tonight. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio tonight, author Robert Kersen, his book, Rocket Men, The Daring Odyssey of Apollo 8 and the Astronauts Who Made Man's First Journey to the Moon. A fascinating story told by Kersen, a great writer behind the New York Times bestselling author of Shadow Divers. This is already a bestseller as well. This story, is, we talk about the genesis of how you found out about it, but it really is a story as much about space as it is about politics. This was the culmination of what presidents before and said needed to be done to win a space race against the Soviet Union.
That's exactly right. Apollo 8 was conceived really in 4 months' time. When normal space flights would take 12 to 18 months planning, they rushed this to the launch pad. It was for very complex but fascinating reasons, one of which dates back to 1961 when John F. Kennedy made a promise, really an insane promise to the country, that we would land man on the moon and bring him back safely by the end of the decade.
And he did that because we were getting our butts kicked by the Soviet Union.
That is exactly right. That is the reason he did it. We were so far behind in the space race. The Soviet Union, our existential mortal enemy, was doing everything first and best in space at the time. And space was considered to be really the final battlefield, the ultimate battlefield. And so there were real existential implications to winning the space race. Kennedy needed something so fantastic, but also something enough into the future that we had a chance to accomplish it before the Soviets. So the idea to land a man on the moon and bring him back was really the perfect thing. The only problem was when he made the promise, NASA had no idea how to do it.
Right.
And so they had 8.5 years to figure it out. So that was one of the motivating forces when Apollo 8 was planned, that we wanted to keep Kennedy's promise to the country. The other was to try to keep the Apollo program moving, because the lunar module, the spidery landing craft used to land men on the moon and bring them back to the orbiting spacecraft, had fallen behind due to production and design problems. So rather than sit there and wait while the space program stalled,
right,
the idea was to send Apollo 8 to do everything but land on the moon.
Up to this point, when we think about the 60s, there are a few successes. There are more failures when you talk about the rockets and the takeoff. There was explosions. There were astronauts who died in some of the missions. It wasn't a done deal that we could get to the moon, let alone land on it. And there was a lot of consternation when it came to this in American space program at the top of it. So talk about, how do you get to a point where, you know, we're not even sure if we can get this done, to, I've got an idea, let's do this quickly.
Right. It still boggles the mind 50 years later how they thought they were going to pull this off so quickly. But a lot of the general concepts were being finalized at the time. Still, there was massive risk undertaken by Apollo 8. And this is what Neil Armstrong talks about when he speaks so reverentially about the flight of Apollo 8. For example, the only rocket powerful enough to deliver men to the moon was the Saturn V.
Mm-hmm.
But the Saturn V had only flown twice, both times unmanned in tests, and it had failed very badly on the second test. So NASA decided that the third flight ever of the Saturn V would not just be manned, but would be 240,000 miles away to the moon.
Right.
The one. And so no man had ever flown on this. So that was just one of myriad risks they were taking. They were also going without the lunar module.
Yes. Now that's a big deal.
Right. A huge deal, because the lunar module, in addition to its primary function of landing men on the moon and bringing them back to the orbiting spacecraft, also served as a backup engine. So if anything went wrong with Apollo 8's primary engine at the moon, if it malfunctioned or didn't fire, they could be trapped in lunar orbit forever or fly off into eternal solar orbit or crash into the lunar surface.
And what would you say the irony of Apollo 13 and that amazing, daring rescue or survival of that when the oxygen tanks blew up in space? They were saved by the lunar module.
They're saved by the lunar module.
Which was not in Apollo 8.
No. So if the same thing happened to Apollo 8 as happened to Apollo 13, they'd still be out there.
It's unbelievable to think about. But there was a lot of risk. And, you know, Frank Borman talks about it. And there is this concern that you're breaking protocol, you're cutting corners, all of this for political win. But as we see today, I mean, we're a divided country and there may be more cynics that would say that this is not the right way to go about it. There wasn't necessarily that chorus because this country, as divided as it was in the late 60s, the one thing they weren't divided about was space travel.
Right. In fact, people needed something to rally around. 1968, you could argue, was one of the most terrible years in our country's history. You had the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. You had violence in the streets, including, of course, here in Chicago at the Democratic Convention. You had 15,000 dead Americans in Vietnam. Often 90% or more of the evening news was dedicated to Vietnam, and you were watching it for the first time unfold. This was an opportunity to watch war, and it was even more horrible than people imagine. Everybody seemed divided against everyone else, and there seemed nothing that could bring this country together by the end of 1968, nothing that could unite us. And yet here these guys pushed this 363-foot rocket out to the launch pad in the very end of 1968 and attempted to fly to the moon for the first time.
It's amazing because if it fails, if NASA cuts corners and does 4 months training instead of 12 months and doesn't have the lunar module attached to it, which is a backup. If it fails, it could be the end of the space program. It could be a situation where there isn't an appetite anymore to do this because obviously what you just said about 1968, it wouldn't have been a good end to a pretty terrible year.
People begged NASA not to do this. I reproduce a letter from a man in Connecticut begging them, saying we've been through too much now. And, you know, he wasn't the only one concerned. There were millions of people concerned, including the head of NASA himself, James Webb, who, when he first heard the idea for Apollo 8, yelled, didn't say, but yelled, and this is a quote, "Are you out of your mind?" And he listed the myriad risks, including the Saturn V and the going without the backup engine. But he concluded by saying, if these men die on this mission, nobody, lovers, poets, no one, will ever look at the moon the same way again.
Wow.
And that was not just true of the moon, it was true of Christmas, because Apollo 8 was scheduled to orbit the moon on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. So imagine if these three American heroes die, who's going to look at the moon or Christmas the same?
It's amazing to think about the risk there. There's so many things that could have gone wrong that aren't just, it wasn't just a normal, like you said, it was Christmas. It's not a normal day. There's so much that was going wrong in that year, yet they went ahead with this. One of the big changes, and this was early in the process, and I forgot who it was, but decided that it was as important to orbit the moon than to land on the moon. The first idea was, hey, we need to get an astronaut to land on the moon, to walk on the moon. But it was someone who came forward and said, you know what, it's as good as landing on the moon as to get into the orbit.
Right. If they could pull off Apollo 8, not only were they going to keep President Kennedy's promise alive, not only were they going to keep advancing the potentially stalled Apollo program, but they also had the chance to beat the Soviets to reach the moon for the first time, the first men to the moon. That was a hugely important step in the space race. But also by doing it, not only would they make those political accomplishments, but they could do and prove almost everything necessary to landing a man on the moon, save for landing the man
himself.
So they could learn the trajectories and the software, the communications. They could scout landing sites for the future landing
mission.
It
could be almost like a trial run.
It's a trial run. But the thing about it is everything for Apollo 8 is going to be for the first time. And that's what Armstrong and Aldrin and others would say later. By the time others went and landed, Apollo 8 had already proved so much of it could be done. But before Apollo 8 went, no one knew if any of it could be done.
And you have a whole chapter about the Soviet Union and the Soviets' push as well. And it was early December. This was Christmas time, 1968. It was early December where there was pins and needles. There was sweat and, you know, biting fingernails from NASA, from the United States, that the Soviet Union was going to beat us to the moon. There was a window there where they could do it, and we didn't know if they were going to be able to do it or not.
No, not only did we not know, it really looked like they were going to do it in early December. In fact, there were reports out of the Soviet Union that the cosmonauts had reported to the launch pad in Kazakhstan along with the rocket, and they wanted to go, and for reasons that are still not completely understood, they backed down. They had some problems on some previous test flights, but they really were ready to go, and to this day, the remaining cosmonauts are heartsick that they didn't do it and beat the United States to send the first
man to
the moon.
But you can understand by the story that you tell about Apollo 8 why the Soviets would say, maybe this is a bad idea. This maybe we haven't thought this through.
They were so scared of it and so overwhelmed by the risks taken by Apollo 8 that even after Apollo 8 launched, many in the Soviet Union did not believe that they had actually done it. It wasn't until the flight was well underway that the reality of it started to sink in.
It's an amazing story. Robert Kersen has written the book Rocket Men, The Daring Odyssey of Apollo 8 and the Astronauts Who Made Man's First Journey to the Moon. He's in studio tonight. We'll take a quick break and an update on tonight's news. Come back. More with Robert Kersen here at the Big Table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio tonight, Robert Kersen. He's the author of Rocket Men, The Daring Odyssey of Apollo 8, and The Astronauts Who Made Man's First Journey to the Moon. And I'm guilty of this as well. When I think of the man's first journey to the moon, I think one giant step, one small step, one giant step, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin. You don't think about the preceding mission, the Apollo 8, which was to bring a manned mission to the orbit of the moon. And it was done, and it was done in a very risky fashion. One of the other aspects of this book, which is just really tremendous, is the astronaut and cosmonauts as well. In the way, but the way that this country rallied around the heroes that they were, there was a much different distinction of what an astronaut was in 1965 to 1970 than it is today.
Yes, very much. The astronauts of the Gemini and Apollo and Mercury era were beyond rock stars. There were so few of them, and they were doing things no human being had ever done. On top of that, so many of them were very good-looking. They had come from fighter pilot and test pilot backgrounds, so they were very exciting. And they were the bravest of the brave, and they were doing this for our country. And it was a nonviolent thing at the time. We were involved in a war, but they were doing something to explore the universe and to advance science and also to advance our place in society. So it was almost an all good proposition, and they were beyond the rock stars, as I said. They were just the ultimate in American heroes.
In interviewing the three astronauts, were they aware of that? Do they recognize who they were or what they meant to the country in the space race? And even they had training as fighter pilots and other military training. Did they recognize what they could be and also recognize the risks?
I think so. I mean, it was pretty apparent to them very early on that they had become instant celebrities because they were on the cover of all the magazines in the country. They were each paid $16,000 by Life magazine for exclusive access to their homes and families, and they were recognized everywhere they went. Not all of them embraced the celebrity lifestyle. Frank Borman, for example, was there. He was a military man on a military mission. He believed getting to the moon was only and everything about beating the Soviets. So he could have done without all the celebrity. But they certainly knew what they were getting into, and they came into it all at once. There was no gradual buildup the way you might see in a rock star who gets a little more recognition, a little more. They were instant celebrities, often coming out of complete obscurity. So it was quite a shock to their lifestyle and to their wives' lifestyle as well.
And as you mentioned, the idea at that time in 1968, there's a lot of news, the war in Vietnam, the assassinations of Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King. There's a lot going on in 1968, the violence, the protests. This was a televised event. This was something that right at Christmas Eve and Christmas that captured the world. Walter Cronkite, everybody involved to be able to create a moment, a news moment. You could say what you want. I love the fact that at that time, NASA did not have, people, they didn't have spokesperson. They gave this to the astronauts. They read passages from the Bible and spoke to the world in orbit of the moon.
Right. They told Frank Borman, on your third telecast of the four that you're going to be doing on this journey, more people will be listening to you than have ever listened to a human voice at once, nearly a third of the world's population. It's going to happen on Christmas Eve as you orbit the moon. Say something appropriate. And to this day, Frank Borman, who's now 90 years old, laughs at that and thinks, can you imagine that happening today? Today it would go through 16 committees and bureaus and focus groups.
Someone would write it for him.
Someone would write it for them, and it would be screened all the way up to the White House. Instead, NASA told him, do something appropriate, and left it to them.
You're in orbit right now. You've done amazing work, and all of the science and all the things have to go on, and you need to talk to the world.
and it has to be perfect. I mean, this is the first time human beings are going to be speaking to other human beings from another world. And they're going to be speaking to everyone, not just people in the United States, not just people in the Soviet Union, everyone. So it fell to them to do the perfect thing. And nobody ever gave them any guidance, and it was just up to them.
That's amazing. And they were, like I said, if you look at the footage, they're perfect in everything that they say and they do. The other part of this, too, is science. It's amazing the calculations, the trajectories, the flight patterns. There's a great harrowing moment where Jim Lovell puts the wrong numbers into that almost destroys the mission as they're on their way back to Earth. It blows my mind at how specific they have to be in their scientific calculations to have success, to the point where if they're off by just a hair, they're dead.
Yes. Bill Anders told me a couple weeks ago, he showed me a wristwatch he had that he said he bought for less than $100. And he said there's more computing power in that wristwatch than was on the entire command module they flew. And in his iPhone, which is, by the way, the latest iteration of the iPhone, there's more computing power than Mission Control had at its entirety. And so with that kind of power and that kind of primitive computing power, they calculated trajectories, distances. They even calculated the time they were supposed to pass behind the moon for the first time when they got there. And they did it to within 1 second of the predicted time they had calculated on the ground.
And you think of all the automation, and you think of watching a rocket take off, SpaceX, this happened not too long ago, where the rocket comes down and lands in the right spot, and you're like, what great computers.
Right.
There was a sense of piloting that went into this mission in 1960. When you're trying to land this craft in the Pacific Ocean at a certain spot, if you're off, if you're just off in your trajectory by a little bit, you're thousands and thousands of miles of where you should be. And it could be days, months, and probably life or death on whether or not you're ever rescued.
Right. And it's not just one thing. It's over and over, many different ways they could make these mistakes through various parts of the mission. Just re-entering the Earth's atmosphere required them hitting an envelope of a width of about 2 degrees, which was the equivalent, they calculated, of throwing a paper airplane into a mail slot from a distance of 4 miles. Anything too shallow, they're going to skip off and they'll be out in the atmosphere with no way to come back. And anything too steep, they're going to burn up and incinerate like a meteorite. They have to hit that mail slot from 4 miles from a paper airplane. Just unthinkable.
And it's unthinkable because what I also took from the book was that NASA couldn't do it any other way. By the rush job, the 4 months, they had enough oxygen for it to hit that envelope. If you bounced off and went back into space, well, that's your oxygen. You're done.
That's it.
There are no safeguards for being off a percent.
No safeguards and no examples of earlier flights that did it wrong or things you could improve upon. As Susan Borman said when she first heard about this flight, everything would be for the first time. Everything. And so that's what makes Apollo 8 so singular and so heroic to so many people who know about it and remember it.
That's a great segue into, you know, my last thought on this is that, you know, so many people, I was born in 1974, but through history and knowing it and even my father and talking about it, you get an understanding of it. And people in this generation who experienced it, it's life-changing. Where they were, they also the walk of the moon, all the space race stuff is life-changing, life-altering. It's a moment in time. Flash forward to 2018, my son's 10 years old, generations before him, 20, 25 years old. They may not even be looking at the moonwalk as something that was a moment in American history. How do you see space travel and what we have done in the last 20, 30 years changing in the way that it used to? We had this hero worship over these astronauts, and today it seems like it's a private pursuit.
Yeah, it does. I think the only thing that might rekindle that kind of excitement and that kind of joy that people experienced, and it was a joy spread throughout the society. It wasn't limited to kids or boys. It was everybody. I think the only way we're going to get that again is to land man on the moon again and maybe to build a colony there or to send men, and when I say men, I mean human beings, to Mars.
Mars, right.
Mars might be trickier than people, than general public realize, but to do either of these things, you may have to feel that your very existence is threatened again. I think part of what made Apollo possible, maybe most of what made Apollo possible, was this terrible fear that we had. And I think it was a realistic one, that our very existence depended on it, that we were in an existential battle against a great enemy, and we needed to do it. It wasn't just that we wanted to do it or would be a good thing. We had to do it.
There was even a thought that if the Soviet Union beat us to the moon, they could just drop bombs on us whenever they felt like it.
That's what the idea of space was, that if you could put men on the moon, you could put soldiers on the moon. If you could fly satellites in orbit, you could drop bombs from those satellites in any given location you wanted. Sputnik terrified people in 1957. First, it thrilled them. A few days later, they realized this has huge military implications. So our backs really were against the wall, and feeling our existence at stake, I think, really pushed us to do something not just spectacular, but even impossible. And there may be another day, I kind of hope there isn't, where we feel so threatened, but that may be what it takes to do something that spectacular again.
It does feel like politics is a great motivator in the sense that that's really what pushed us to do this. And it's been replaced with this entrepreneurial spirit. You see more people who want to get into privatizing space travel. I mean, is there a way that we can be motivated by the almighty American dollar?
Well, it's starting to look that way. If you watch the launch of Falcon Heavy and seen those retro rockets land themselves, it looked like something out of a science fiction film, then you have to be very grateful for the private entrepreneurs who are putting their money into that, because one of the big problems with government-sponsored space exploration is that it's incredibly expensive. And there's always an argument to divert those funds to something that we could use more immediately here, healthcare or any number of other things. So it's hard to make the case to the American public that we should be spending so many tax dollars. So you have to really be grateful for the entrepreneurs at this point.
After doing this book and of course, all of the touring with it, do you see the space race and the space program in a whole different light?
I do. I think it's even more miraculous than I understood when I first got into it. The minds that were involved and the youth. Frank Borman told me that he believed the average age of the trajectory specialists during Apollo 8 was 24 years old.
Wow.
So to think of the youth involved and that they were all doing this again for the first time ever, and that they got them, they wanted the orbit at 69 miles above the moon, and that's exactly where the orbit ended up. Just incredible. So the respect that I have for the people who pulled this off just grows and grows.
The book is called Rocket Men, The Daring Odyssey of Apollo 8 and the Astronauts Who Made Man's First Journey to the Moon. The author, Robert Kersen, journalist and author, used to work here at the Chicago Sun-Times. Robert, thanks so much for being my guest tonight at the Big Table. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's an honor to be here. Thanks so much for having me.